Hi, I'm Megan M. Riley from MeganMRiley.com. I'm a natural born psychic and sexual empowerment coach, and you are listening to Women's Guide to Living the Orgasmic Life. Hello, goddesses. This is beautiful and sweet, and I can't wait to share it with you. Sarah Higgins and I went to high school together a few years ago, and to come back around this long later is a sweetness. And this is also the first time that Sarah has shared publicly her story and her family story, and there's a rawness to it. It's also vulnerable and sweet. And I hope that you can hear that healing is possible. And I hope that if you do hear yourself in what it has been like and the feel of this is permanent, the feel of being too broken and too much, that you can hear there is another side. Sarah Higgins, welcome.
Thank you.
The sweetness of this conversation, which is, let's see, what are we now? 26 years in the making?
Yeah. We met in high school. I sat behind you in chemistry class.
And here we are this week with Kavanaugh, with everything that's happening. This couldn't be more perfect. I'm so honored that you are here, that you are willing to share everything. I think it's time. It's time that we share. It's time that we lead each other through. It's time that we lead each other through healing, that women heal women, that this is it. And there's so much more to you. Sarah Higgins, mom, wife, mindful muse, lives in Madison, Wisconsin, and is the founder of Mind, Body, Soul, where she trains yoga teachers, teaches yoga, and coaches individuals in keto eating and living. So how did that happen?
That's been a process in the works for the last really 17 years. So, I mean, in many ways, this is kind of the start to my story of beginning to, you know, find yoga and that pathway and how that became a tool for healing. But yeah, it started 17 years ago, I would say, when a friend invited me and repeatedly invited me and wouldn't let me get out of it to actually go to an actual yoga class. When I was there in that very first class, I knew I had like an awakening in my heart where I felt like this was the language of my life. The words, the experience was my song, my spirit. It felt like my church, my home, my language for sure. And like within the next 10 minutes of recognizing that I would be a teacher. Mm-hmm. And so then I spent the rest of the class kind of freaking out because I had an enormous fear of public speaking and getting up in front of a group. And I was like, why does this always happen to me? Like, I want to do something, but to get there, I'm going to have to do a lot. And I just never gave it up. I loved it so much. It did so much for me. And I think like many other yoga teachers, you then want to offer it out. And so I created a business, and it primarily began with me teaching yoga around the community to friends. I taught out of my home. I taught at many studios, several businesses, and then it just kind of evolved from there. And now I've got some other elements to it, but it's still growing. It still seems like it's a very young and ripe place for a lot of creation.
Do you get a lot of tears in class?
Oh, heavens, yes. So in the beginning, I could not understand why every time I practiced yoga, every time there would be the window of, you know, the period of time that I would have tears. Oftentimes in final resting pose or shavasana, corpse pose at the end, sometimes in back bends, sometimes in hip openers. Sometimes even in the warrior, the standing, the balance, you know, I mean, it would just come out at different times. And I once had a teacher tell me, you know, because I think that it was visible, I cried every time. And not that I would try to hide it. I knew that that was part of it, to allow that to happen and to just let it kind of ride through or wash through as part of the experience. But I remember being told that that's fullness. Like, that's good. That's purna. That's pure. That's an overabundance of sweet nectar when it comes out like that. you know, that that's part of it. And in some ways I would say that's transmutation.
I remember when I first started going to yoga, I had to do something like yoga for stiffs and still really disconnected, emotionally inflamed, physically inflamed, the whole thing. And I would get to Shavasana and sob. And I had no idea what was going on. And that actually, I hear, is a normal thing.
Yeah, I think teachers need to be reminding beginners of that, reminding students consistently that all emotions are part of the practice. You know, and even if you're a teacher and you hear this all the time and you know this to be true, people coming to you are coming because they need healing. Mm-hmm. They're coming because they are trying to move through their own personal traumas and experiences, whether they know it or not. That is a very necessary reminder that it's about all of the emotions. It's not about being perfect or happy or bubbly and feeling great and elated. It's about moving through the dark stuff too.
So tell me about your transformation.
You know, my aim with sharing this, because I've shared it with lots of people. I've shared before in other mediums, but never in this format, never on a podcast, never like in this one-on-one kind of exchange situation, which, you know, I think we're doing this with the intention of leading the way for other people to share their own stories. I do this because I'm ready to. It feels like that's what I need to do for myself, but also because when I was recognizing what had happened to me, when I was admitting it to myself, when I was dealing with memories that had been repressed, I felt like there was nobody to talk to. I felt like I didn't know how to share. I didn't know who to reach out for help. I felt extremely vulnerable. There was, you know, so much shame and secrecy that had been around it for so long. What I did naturally, I love to go to the library. I love to do my own research. And so this was before we had Google and before we used the internet. And I went to the local library and I picked up every book. I searched every glossary and every index looking for sexual abuse. And I brought home stockpiles of books to try to figure out what I was dealing with and how I could best heal from it. None of that stuff was rich enough. None of it had enough of an impact. It all seemed very scientific and straightforward. And, you know, there are some stories, but not being able to hear the person's voice, not being able to go back and hear it again, those different medium. And this is perhaps something new that we are bringing into our culture, which I'm really excited about.
Yes.
You know, I love listening to other people's stories on all sorts of different topics. And so this is my first podcast. I'm a little bit of a rookie at it, but appreciative of this opportunity to connect, to, you know, to support each other, to be present and to be available. Like the worst feeling is to feel like you're alone or to feel like something's wrong or fundamentally broken, which that's just part of it. That's the shit you have to deal with again and again sometimes. If you and I and everyone else, like I'm so assured by Dr. Ford, you know, her experience that we witnessed last week was an affirmation. You and I had talked before. And if there was an inkling of doubt, which I don't think there was, but for me, that was like a now is the time. Gather around, tune in, listen. Like we need each other more than ever before. And more than ever before, we're finally having the opportunity to show up for each other, to listen to each other, and to be heard.
Yes.
Maybe this is the secret sauce to create change. I don't know.
I think it's the conversation. I think we're not talking about it. And as we don't talk about it, we don't tell our husbands, we don't tell our boyfriends, we don't tell our fathers, we don't tell our brothers, because they might be uncomfortable. Well, here you and I are, decades later, finally able to have the conversation. And to watch and listen to Dr. Ford last week, I felt like we were all holding her by the small of her back. And as her voice quivered, and as she told her story, that we're all just right there. It was so emotional and powerful.
You used the word congruent in an Instagram post that you shared. And that just to me wrapped it all up. Like that's what we were experiencing, was you could feel it. You could hear it. It shook me to my core in a good way, in a wake the fuck up way, like everybody. So my story, you asked, like, tell me your story. I have one of those experiences that my repressed memories came rolling out while I was giving birth to my firstborn. So that was 17 years ago. So I'm in this extended birthing process, which is, you know, somewhere around the hour of 17 hours now. And I'm stalled because I'm thinking about these repressed memories. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, I'm having this whole, unbeknownst to everyone else, they think I'm giving birth and I'm processing. And, you know, I had a doula. It was a natural birth. Everything was beautiful. That's the truth of what I was dealing with. And I remember at one point being in the bathtub, holding my husband's hand and tapping into the strength of womanhood, the sisterhood of women who have been there before, who will go after to the ancient primordial divine feminine without even knowing that that's what it was, and feeling that cord of connection. I allowed myself to say, okay, I'm moving forward with this birth. I mean, by that point, the birth was moving forward. But in the following postpartum 6 months, I was able to put on the face of everything's great, but I was experiencing a lot of internal trauma and anxiety and depression and ruminating about what had happened to me. And I didn't want to tell my husband. I didn't want to tell anybody because I didn't want to take anything away from the experience of being new parents, of taking care of this new life. That's where my friend, who consistently appeared and reminded and requested and insisted that I came to yoga, you know, she showed up repeatedly and got me to that first class. And that first time I had this is the language of my heart. I know I'm supposed to be here. I had a little bit of fear around it, but I was willing to move through it because I felt so much better afterwards. You know, it helped me sleep better. My mood felt better. But what would happen is because I had so much anger about my childhood trauma, my childhood sexual abuse that, you know, came bubbling to the surface when I was giving birth. I had so much anger about that, that I would do my yoga practice and the buzz or the enlightenment, the feel good feelings would last for about 48 to 72 hours. And then I'd be pissed. I'd be really angry, which is not a fun or easy place at all to be as a mom, where you're trying to stuff that and mute that. Mm-hmm. And so my once a week yoga practice developed into two or three times or four times because I needed it. And my husband could see how much it was helping me. So he was so instrumental in supporting me. Like, you need this. It's that same logical piece of wisdom we hear over and over again, but don't necessarily apply to our lives, is you have to take care of yourself. You have to fill your own cup before you can take care of anybody else. So it was just this self-evident exploration. I eventually, about 6 months in of starting yoga, got the courage to talk to my husband about it. And I'm really lucky that we have a deep soul connection. We share the ability to communicate extremely well with each other. And his response was so perfect. I don't even remember what it was, other than it's exactly what I needed. And I realized, unfortunately, that's not always the case. And I got to experience that through some other instances, like when I shared with my parents. Looking back, I'm not sure that that was necessary at that point. There's really nothing they could do. You know, I was so young when it happened. It was like 6, 7, somewhere in there. And it was a neighbor, prominent business family, somebody my dad had done business with. Mm. And, you know, somebody who also belonged to the same church. So there was so many years had passed that there's really, it's too late to do any, I don't know, I guess kind of statutes of limitations, for example, are gone. Mm-hmm. So there's really nothing, no action you can take. And I remember regretting telling them. I think I rushed into that, even though I had read in some of those library books, you know, be careful who you tell. Mm-hmm. You don't have to tell. Like, telling isn't always the right thing. And I would say that's true, that if I could go back, I would have handled that piece of it very differently. I think part of that is the cycle of abuse, like the power that's held over, you know, the abuser who can kind of incite that kind of fear is something that needs to be recognized. There's nothing wrong with you not wanting to tell somebody. I think that for me, that was one of my superpowers. I remember making a commitment to myself as a young child saying, now I think it was in second grade, they taught us that if you bottle up emotions, they'll come roiling out and you'll get sick and it'll end up worse. that kind of thing. I can remember making a conscious decision of, I can handle this. I think I can keep this bottled up. I think I'm okay. I think I'll share when I have my own life, my own family, when my hair is gray, people listen to me, you know, like, wow. I think I'll share then. And lo and behold, that's just what happened. As a youth, I didn't have the brain capacity to know. I didn't have the developmental capacity to understand the consequences of not getting help for that kind of trauma, which was very significant. The rape of a young child, the witnessing of other abuse and sexual acts happening to his children, being threatened by gun violence. It was definitely substantial. And I say that only because I guess I need a pat on the back right now, but All of us have had an experience, and it doesn't matter what that experience is. It does. But what matters most perhaps is being able to connect with other people who get you, because that's when you can say, yeah, I'm right. I can heal. I can do the work. Nobody is like given me the magical formula or the path to follow. You know, I've tried lots of different things which all support your healing, but in my personal opinion, the healing happens when there's a willingness to heal. And some of this is stuff I've learned, and through my practice of yoga, is the choice to not be a victim anymore. That embodiment choice to say, I want to be confident. I want to be free of shame and guilt. I want to cradle that little girl and let her shine and live a full life that was meant to be lived, not repressed or hidden or pushed down or abused in any way or taken advantage of. I've come to the realization, and I love to share this with my stress management students and with my own yoga students, that the healing you're seeking is already within you. It's there. Open to it, like soften to it. Part of that comes with acceptance of where you're at. You know, you mentioned you did yoga for stiff bodies. Like, an embodiment practice doesn't have to be yoga. It can be anything that puts you in your body, that you're moving with your breath, that you're connecting to your physical sense as well.
Let's back up just a little bit, because I know that there are women that are still in very much victim, very much alone. Can you describe, can you remember what that was like? And if they can hear you in them, that they can see that there's another side.
It's the worst feeling. It's so isolating. It's so dark and sticky and deep and hard. It's such an uncomfortable place and a desperate place, a very lonely and scary place to be. And it can seem like an endless space, that it'll always be that way. I can remember feeling like, I'm always going to be fucked up. Something's always going to be wrong. I've heard you say this in your podcast before. If only this didn't happen to me, Then I would be successful. Or blaming like shyness or low self-esteem or particular ways of thinking and viewing life as a problem because of what happened. And I think it was my yoga practice. At least it was the practice of showing up for myself more than anything that allowed me to kind of get a glimmer here and a glimmer there, a moment, a step forward, a little pulling back of the veils, a little polishing of the heart, a little clarity of, oh, that's a thought I don't need to be thinking anymore, or that's no longer serving me, or here's a way I can have a healthier boundary. Not that anything was wrong with me, but beginning to see what's right with me. Beginning to see even and believe even in the blessings. And I think, you know, through the first shares and connections of other people, having had similar experiences or their own traumas to digest, when you can relate and resonate, when you can offer empathy to somebody else, that just is so powerful and healing in and of itself. It's a normal human experience to be there. And so many of us have been there, will be there again, but it's also not a permanent state.
So now you have a newborn baby, you're going through your processing, clearing, learning about yoga, learning about breath. You are married and you're able to share with your husband, but still, that's a lot. And then I can hear you go from victim to survivor to change maker. You are in the change maker state. And at this point, are you sharing as you're teaching?
I think there were certain people I shared with, definitely. I shared with some of my mentors and teachers along the way. There are certain times when you're in yoga teacher training where you're very immersed in the studies and spending a lot of time with people. And there can be, you know, a lot of deep relationships and story sharing that happens there. And I think what I found was how frequent it was happening. I started to feel more normal. Like, I'm not so alone. Oh my gosh, everybody here has some kind of story. And it's very relatable, you know, without even needing to go into everybody's details. Like you said, you're just part of the club. It doesn't matter what or how or when. It feels the same, I think.
Yes. For women, I think the most powerful words are me too.
Me too. Yeah.
So then as you grow your family and you grow a practice and you're leading and healing, you also are the mother of a survivor.
So my third child, when she was 4.5, 5 ish, so it was repeated and happened more than once. She was molested at a daycare, a certified licensed daycare, one that had all the stars, all the licenses, all of the recommendations, all of the personal references. In my own paranoia to prevent this happening, you know, in my own effort to make sure that this would never happen to my kids, it happens. It was a situation where it was the daycare provider's boyfriend who was not on the records, had not been background checked, even though that's what we were told. I would say it was more than just the assault that she went through or assaults that she experienced. When she told the daycare provider, which is what I had schooled her on and educated her on, you know, if somebody touches your privates, you tell. That's why, you know, we talk to our kids like that. We let them know, you know, you keep telling until somebody believes you. She told the daycare provider, who said, well, maybe he needs a timeout.
Oh.
So her initial ask for help was shut down by somebody she loved and trusted. And I knew something wasn't right, but I also self-doubted. I thought that it was my own fears, my own paranoia, my own like over sensitivity and hyper awareness towards these types of things. What happened was he was also molesting his daughter, who went to the police at 16. That opened up, you know, some information that he had been arrested was visible on the news, which then led to the daycare provider to send out an email to everybody there. And the parents decided to meet, and we met in the evening at a library in a conference room. And we went around the table, and bless everyone there who was willing to share what they had been seeing at home and what they were afraid of, because it was one of the worst nightmares that you can imagine. Is to see your kids, to know your child has experienced what you know to be so painful. And so in many ways, decapacitating or debilitating.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter was the oldest, so she was the most verbal. He ended up being arrested and charged and spent time in jail for what he did to his own daughter. And the judge is aware of the daycare children. Most of the kids, not all of them, did interviews with detectives, and there's just no way they're going to put a 5-year-old up on the stand.
Right.
But she still remembers, and she still talks about it, and statute of limitations are still in effect. And if that's part of her process moving forward that she wants to share with that, I fully support it. And maybe it won't ever be. But, you know, as hard as this has been, that was just devastating for the whole family. And as hard as that has been, there have also been the, you know, it's kind of like I got to go through the whole process again, but it was also like I was doubly in the process because I knew what healing required, if that makes sense. On one hand, I was like, thank God I've had my own experience because I can talk to her about this. I can say, I know me too. And then on the other hand, there's that maternal fear of, oh God, I know what this does. You don't want that for your babies. You don't want that for your kids ever. And it took a lot of time. You know, I was teaching yoga really heavily then, lots of drop-in classes, lots of amazing experiences. And that I I couldn't share. I didn't share. I sat with it. And I ended up at the same time having a really significant injury to my Achilles heel and to like 5 tendons and ligaments in my ankle.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And I just was like, this is my Achilles heel. This is my thing. Like I need to work on, I need to figure this out. This is my karma, my dharma, my everything. Like I have to stop. I have to back off because I had so much anger. I had so much anger at everything and everyone, but even at yoga. Like I realized, oh, damn it. I've been using yoga as nothing more than a coping mechanism, like just a place to hide and run away. It didn't solve my problem. It's still fucking here, you know, and even bigger now. I'm a shit storm. Yes. I'll be damned if I'm going to send loving blessings out to everybody else. You know, It just was like really, it felt really false. It felt really cheesy to me because I had such a significant physical injury. It was extremely painful. You know, every pose hurt, everything hurt. I ended up leaving a lot of my teaching positions to heal my ankle, but I was also healing my daughter, my family, and myself. And sitting with, what does yoga really mean to me? What does healing really mean to me now? And the gift in all of that was my meditation practice just soared. You know, the ability to relax deeply, deep relaxation, yoga nidra, yoga sleep, meditation, mindfulness, all of that started to blossom where I realized like all the other limbs of yoga started to open up to me where it wasn't just about the poses anymore. So much more behind it that I could play with and discover and work with as remedies to heal. But also going into that with the knowledge of not to abuse the practice, not to use it as an excuse to not deal with everything, to not bypass. If I had not had that ankle injury, sure shit, I would have been on my mat hours and hours sweating, pouring out, twisting everything, like just wringing it out because that feels so good to me. But that's nothing more than an over-exercise obsession reappearing, which is something I had healed from before. You know, I no longer was using exercise to abuse, but kind of when I had to really step back and look at it.
And that spiritual bypass, that's a juicy one because we can get away with it here. We can get away with it in yoga and speak of forgiveness and cutting the cords and all is well and blessings and then inside be churning. And I did spiritual bypass for 15 years.
It pissed me off because I thought I'm not spiritually bypassing. You don't see it when you are. You can't, you're blind to it. You don't know what you don't know.
Namaste, motherfucker.
Damn it. I'm like back at square one here, but it's a different square one.
How do you use this now? You have these two awful experiences that could have taken you out and your daughter out. And now you are leading. You are leading courses. You are leading women. Who are you now? What do you do to stay centered?
For me, taking care of myself has shifted more to a priority. I think it was so easy to put everybody else's needs first. And I mean, just history has proven to me time and time again that when I do that, I'm no use to anybody. And I quickly suffer the consequences physically, mentally, spiritually, emotionally. So self-care for me is just non-negotiable. And it's the gift I give myself every day. It's the recognition, the affirmation that life is here and I'm here to show up and live it and experience it, whatever comes my way. For me, it looks like meditation. It looks like relaxation. I'm huge on the art of being able to relax and enjoy just being without doing. Nature is my nectar. Lately, I love creating. I've never thought of myself as an artist. I've been realizing like, I'm a meditation artist. I love to write. I love to share meditations with people. And I've been playing around with inks and, you know, allowing myself just to create and make without needing it to do anything or be anything. So that's been a healthy outlet. And the other thing, I love to cook and nourish my family.
Mm.
So the whole keto thing came to me. I chose to practice that out of dietary need. My body did not respond well to gluten. I had figured that out 7 or 8 years ago when I was pregnant with our third. And so, you know, working with a naturopath, I had figured it out. Working with medical doctors, I had figured it out. I could not do gluten. That worked for a while, but then like that ankle injury, like the amount of inflammation I had in my body, and any time I got injured, it took forever to heal mm-hmm. or wouldn't heal. And I realized something was just fundamentally off in my biosphere, in my biomes, in my physical being. Something was not quite right. And I stumbled, actually it was a yoga student of mine from the college who had posted something about keto on Facebook, and I had never heard of it. And so I looked at it and I researched it. And, you know, my dad died of stomach cancer. And before that, he had heart disease. Before that, he had type 2 diabetes. He had a triple aneurysm, which he survived. But there's that history in my DNA where I did not want to repeat that. And here I am, not healthy. Despite having, you know, a great yoga practice, I still wasn't healthy. So it made sense to me and it just clicked. And I decided in that moment, I'm going to do this to take care of my body. It wasn't a difficult decision. It was like, I'm going to try it. And within a couple of days, I mean, I picked like the worst time, you know, I say that sarcastically, because I think a lot of people would use the excuse, oh, I'm going on vacation, I can't start a new way of eating now.
Mm-hmm.
An awesome exercise is a great opportunity. And we took a road trip from here out to the Rocky Mountains and 16 hours in a car with coolers. And, you know, we didn't eat out. We got up to Estes Park and I was feeling alive and amazing. And like, this is so good. Like just clear. I just felt clear. And plus all the benefit of being on vacation with my husband. And I didn't say anything to anybody. I just had, you know, lots of options to choose from for everybody and took care of myself. My husband noticed and he's like, are you eating different?
Huh?
Are you doing something different? Because you're like, go, go, go. And I was like, yeah, hey, this is what I'm doing. And he's like, well, cool. I'll do it with you. I'm like the luckiest, right? I get that.
Wow.
Yeah. So like there up in the cabin in Estes Park, he makes this big shift with me. It works so well for him too. And so just that new way of cooking and viewing food, finally food for me became nourishment and a self-care vehicle instead of something to abuse or misuse or to medicate with or to not medicate with, you know, so to deprive or to over-exercise it out of my body or to have an unhealthy relationship with food was such a part of my life, you know. And I can look back and say, well, it's really common, people who have had a history of sexual trauma to mm-hmm. have a disordered eating habit. And so for me, it was like, I could finally feel the fuel from food. It finally physically made sense. It wasn't just a mental shift. It was like, wow, I can actually feel it. When I drink my bulletproof coffee, I can actually feel it. I never used to be able to fast because I was so on so many like carbs and starches and sugars that my body just couldn't do it. It wasn't about willpower. I would get physically sick. I'd get a smashing headache. I would feel nauseous. I would get so hangry and crabby. Mm-hmm. But with this, you know, intermittent fasting after a couple months of keto just all of a sudden just showed up and said, here I am. Mm-hmm. And I do this intuitively. I'm not, you know, tracking every single day and macros and all that stuff. I did it a couple of times just to kind of like get my boundaries and parameters. And if I'm having a big shift, I'll do it again to make sure I'm, you know, still where I need to be. Like if I'm not feeling well, but I haven't felt this great in like ever. And I don't think it's for everyone. You know, it's not everyone will feel better on this. It just happens to work for me.
Mm-hmm.
If anybody's interested in trying it or doesn't have support, I offer that to people. I've done some small group coaching through that or one-on-one coaching.
Oh, that's so good.
This is not any kind of diagnosis. This is just my opinion. But yeah. Those of us that have been through a lot of emotional inflammation seem to have then a similar reaction to food, and we medicate or abuse food and medicate or abuse our body. And it would go one way or another for me. So either I'm using food to medicate or I'm abusing my body to medicate. And keto just takes all of that away. It's just not even an issue anymore.
Yeah. I don't think about food all the time. That was part of the problem was obsessing about food, what I had just eaten, how I felt, what I was going to eat next. And now it's just, when I don't need food, I'm not even thinking about it. Other than, okay, I do have a family of five I've got to cook for and feed for. So the planning, like, oh, it's time to go to the grocery store. But, you know, I used to go to the grocery store and just feel like tempted and hungry and like, you know, ravenous for everything. And now it's like, well, logistically, we need this, this, this. And it's just easier. That's a gift. That's a lucky thing.
Tell me about how you speak to women about apologizing. And apologizing for the things that they say, for taking space, for being emotional. How do you speak to and encourage women around that?
That's an excellent question, and one we all need to consider and come back to again and again as a practice. I teach my students to take up space. You know, that's part of breath work, is take up as much space as you can. That you're worthy of taking up space. That you're worthy of being here. That you're worthy of coming into your fullness. You know, in the Midwestern culture, it's very common to apologize for everything, to say sorry. Mm-hmm. We were just talking about this as a group in my stress management class today, how we're just trained that way. We grew up this way to say, oh, sorry, or to apologize, like in emails. And I don't know, there's so much apologizing. And for what? Like, just speak your truth, stand on your ground, breathe your breath, and be real. That you don't have to hide. To me, I feel like when an apology is necessary, it needs to be a genuine apology where there's a real connection, healthy communication, and a path or plan for what you, if you're apologizing, how you plan to behave moving forward. But there's no need to accept an apology if you're not ready to accept somebody's apology. I think we are in such a culture of wanting to please others, and yet we're so displeased with ourselves. And what if we focused on pleasing ourselves first? Then I don't even think it's really an issue. And you begin to automatically attract the people into your life's experiences where you're not feeling obligated to apologize or feeling like you need to. I think it's a habit for a lot of people to over-apologize. You never need to apologize for being a human. You are here. And you don't need to apologize for the feelings that you're having. That's part of being a human. But with that being said, I think there's total onus is on each of us to do what we need to do and get the help we need to do the work we need to do, whether that's therapy, counseling, whether it's a new embodiment practice or a new support system, you know, a healthier support system. That's part of our jobs. I think we have to say we are adults, we're human, and we're going to do this. You know, as a mom who has a kid and kids who need healing from trauma, I have to advocate. I have to be the squeaky wheel. I have to be the parent who goes in and has those difficult conversations with school administration, with other friends, family friends. And you have to be there and stand up for them. I think there's so much discomfort around talking about sexual abuse in general. You know, a lot of times I'll see people will ask how I'm doing or how's your daughter doing with all of that? And then when I begin to share, the phones come out and scrolling starts to happen. I see that though as A, well, okay, maybe they're not the best people to be telling, or B, it's uncomfortable. I think we're really uncomfortable with heartfelt connections. More and more people are so isolated and alone these days, despite having all these wonderful tools and devices to be able to connect. You know, more often than not, when you're looking at social media, you feel like shit afterwards.
Right.
Or feel less than, you know, so we're actually feeling more disconnected, even though we're technically more connected through our smartphones. It can be really tiring and exhausting to have those kinds of conversations. It can feel really awkward. And, you know, is this an appropriate person to be talking to, you know, teachers, principals, school counselors, doctors, but you have to do it, you know, whether it's for your kid or for yourself. And I think the benefit in doing that is we start to normalize the conversation, the subject. We start to show how prevalent it is. Like, yep, this happened to my kid too. And I can't tell you how many people, adults that, you know, are in her support team that have a shared experience. But without making that connection, if you don't make that connection, and we've learned from mistake, not making that connection, what ends up happening is then there's a problem. There's oversensitivity is a problem instead of a gift. You know, hyper-awareness is causing distraction instead of, oh, I get it. Why she's always aware of the doorway. Where would you like to sit in the classroom? You know, understanding how trauma works in the brain for healing and learning has been kind of a tremendous thing to be learning about. And the impact is so significant.
It's so significant. Or just hypervigilance, to be in hypervigilance for decades and not know that that all that is just trauma.
Yeah.
And if we can soothe that, when we can soothe the hyper alert and the hypervigilance and always scanning and always assuming the worst about someone, when we can finally soothe that part of us, then what's possible? And it becomes so much of a part of our identity. We don't know it could be possible. I love this.
Thank you for listening. As a parent going through this experience, which somehow, you know, it's one thing when it's yourself, but it's a completely other thing when it's your kid. Mm-hmm. And I look around and just statistically speaking, there are so many other moms on the playground, so many other moms at the grocery store, so many other parents. I mean, this was devastating for my husband too. How do you heal from that? How do you come back together as a family? How do you come back into society and how do you build trust? For me, for us, it has been talking about it. It has been communicating. It has been being willing to be uncomfortable. That has made the blessings of all of it start to appear. You know, if you can sit with that really hard stuff and hold it and be there and, like you say, metabolize it, what comes out is so amazing.
It's uncomfortable because we still connect sexual abuse with sexuality. And so if I were to tell a brother, right, then he's picturing me in a sexual image when this is the thing of separating. This is the thing that we have to separate. Sexual abuse is not sexuality. We can have the conversation. You can speak to other parents. You can speak to teachers. And that the more and more you speak it, the less they are then picturing something sexual about your daughter.
Right.
I think it's some desensitization, but let them be uncomfortable. But I love how you are the advocate for her. You are the advocate for yourself. You are the advocate for your family and for all the other children that this happened to, and that you don't stop talking.
Right. You don't. You make the appointments. You show up. You pop in when you need to. You address every single thing. And I'm so fortunate that my daughter is able to tell me when things are happening. She's able to communicate to me, you know, physical sensations she's having in her body, what's happening to her emotionally, physically, and mentally. So to be able to take that and in the context of a trauma situation and make sense of it and find a solution that works, it's also teaching her to advocate for herself. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, you know, and I always ask her permission, like, do you want me to talk to so-and-so about this? Would you like me to help you? Yes. Should we have a conversation with them? Yes. Do you want to have the conversation with them and I'll be there listening? Or do you want me to do the talking? And what I'm finding more and more is she wants to do the talking and she is taking control of what she wants. And I love it. She's 8 years old and she can say, this is what's bothering me. This is why it's bothering me. And this is what I want to happen. This is the solution I need. This is what would work for me. This is how you can help me. In many ways, I have to go to lots of people asking for help. And what a great thing to teach our kids how to ask for help, that that's not the problem. That's okay. And out of it has grown great working relationships, a great education opportunity.
Which is the age where you said, I got this. I can handle it.
Yep. So, yep. And I decided to do it alone.
What a beautiful healing to have her at 8 be able to ask for what she needs and first distinguish what she has. I'm 44 and I am just learning to distinguish what it is that I need.
Yeah, it's wild. Nice. It's wild. It's like, oh my gosh. So there it is where I said the gifts just kind of show up when you're willing to sit with the ugly stuff, with the hard stuff. The other side of it is, wow, there's so much power. There's so much grace and so much potential for that change to happen.
Sarah, thank you so much. Thank you for your courage and your grace and the time just to connect. How do we find you and tell us about you?
You know, the best way you can help me is, you know, send me a little comment on Instagram, Sarah Higgins Yoga. Let me know you listened. Give me a like, connect with me there. My website is sarahhigginsyoga.com. That's Sarah with an H. But I want you to know that you're not alone. You're never alone. And it does get better. The healing is already there inside you and it's just waiting to emerge. And there are lots of different ways you can access your own personal healing. And talk about it, you know, talk to the right people about what happened, get the help that you need, get support, find women, women that can heal you, women that believe you, women who will say me too, get that hit of empathy, reach out. And if it needs to be Megan, if it needs to be me, we're here, we'll listen, we're vessels for this, but never give up, you know, and there's nothing wrong with you.
Thank you. We want to hear if you have told your story and need to tell it again. If you haven't told your story, we want to hear it. You can send us emails. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. This is going to heal, and this is going to heal through conversation. And the more that we talk about it, and the more that we get it out there, and the more that we talk about the healing that is possible, if the people who are around you are tired of hearing the impact on you and are tired of you being hypervigilant and are tired of how you are, and you think that you are just too broken and too fucked up, and this just is going to be the rest of your life, it is not that way. It is really, really not that way. You can find us. I will put Sarah's info in the notes, but tag us, like us, rate the podcast so we can reach even more people. And for those of you who are liking and sharing, I'm really, really honored. Bye, guys.
This is Megan Riley. You have been listening to The Women's Guide to Living the Orgasmic Life. If you'd like more information, my website is meganmriley.com. And go shake those hips!